Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
I was lost.
This week on the podcast, Ulf from Ace of Base, the third biggest selling artist to have come out of Sweden, behind Roxette and, of course, ABBA.
Believe the hype, you're in trouble.
This is a surprising story, one of violence.
The fan brings her with a knife on her throat and drags her up the stairs.
And a story of a misspent youth.
Suddenly having a flirtation with the extreme right. How does that come about?
This is about popularity and unpopularity.
They really killed us in media in Sweden.
This is not one to miss, so don't go away. Ulf is full of surprises.
This was the beginning of the end.
Well, hi, Ulf. I mean, this has been a lifetime ago that I was in Gothenburg and I was in a bar for MTV, and that is where I met Ace of Base, and you were there, of course. Time ago. You're looking very smart in a suit. You just said that you've been to see your lawyer, so I guess the suit was for the lawyer, not for me.
Oh, well, sometimes I do dress up, not only in t-shirts and other things, but I like to dress up a little bit. Yeah, I've been with my lawyers today. We've been running a little bit back and forth in this beautiful spring day in Stockholm. Sun is out and everybody's very happy to get out of the COVID times and winter times.
So let me take you back to Gothenburg. When I do this podcast, I always talk about the very early years of people and what sort of music their parents listened to and when your musical tastes changed and what did they go to? How did they diverge from your parents?
Yeah, that's a big diversion because my father was a jazz fan. He only had this very thick... it was not vinyl, well, it was kind of vinyl, but it was different material. You couldn't bend them, you know, these old from the 50s and the 60s. He had a lot of records at home and he listened to a lot of jazz music. My grandfather on my mother's side, he played a lot of piano, more classical music. So I didn't really have a lot of pop culture from home, but I developed my own pop culture from actually hearing ABBA in the 70s and then Kraftwerk 1979. When I was a little kid, 9 years old. So that was very completely different from my parents' music. However, my father was a computer engineer already in the 70s. So he bought me a Commodore 20 and I got very excited to program. And my first program I did was a synthesizer. So that matched very well with Kraftwerk. And when they came out with Computer World, Computer Welt in German, it was really, for me, it was like, being religious. I just saw these computers taking over the world. You can do everything with them, including fantastic music. So it was kind of inspired by my dad, but not through the music, but through his profession.
Were they culturally aware? I mean, I know you say your dad was into jazz music. I don't know what, you know, you presumably were brought up by your dad and mum. Were they culturally aware of what was going on in the music scene in Sweden?
No, not at all. My mother, she's a child psychologist, or was, and my father was a mathematics and computer engineer. So they were very isolated in their world. What they could hear of the that time modern music, or well, it was not that modern music, but it was obviously synth music and so forth, the pop culture, was a lot of noise from my bedrooms way too late in the evenings. So I don't think there was a good start for them to like the pop culture early 80s, because it was just loud music that woke them up in the middle of the night.
I mean, you mentioned two bands there, ABBA, of course. You know, I mean, forever connected with Sweden, Eurovision, and actually were for a long period not that popular in Sweden, which was seems quite weird today, yeah, considering how big they are. And the other one, of course, Kraftwerk from Dusseldorf in Germany. Now, that album came out in 78, and you would have been 8 years old. The ABBA won the Eurovision Song Contest when you were four. When was it that you actually got into Kraftwerk? Because if I look back at an eight-year-old me, you know, I think I was listening to, I don't know, some really dreadful crap at that point.
Well, I think it comes down to that we had friends of mine in my class, their big brothers, they started to listen to Kraftwerk. So that's, I think, when I was in their home, I thought they were cool guys, their big brothers, they were 2 years older. So I kind of, that's how I got into the synth music. They were like, they loved synth music. And of course, when Depeche Mode came out, 81, So I Will Speak and Spell, it was just a wow moment for all of us. It was all inspired by friends, big brothers.
So what appealed to you about ABBA?
I just love the melodies. And then I didn't really follow the media storm around ABBA, how bad it was, because I didn't read the newspapers that much. But of course, I have realized afterwards, especially when we became successful, when you start studying ABBA's history, that people basically had the ABBA albums hidden behind the stereos, didn't have them among the other vinyls. And basically, there was not one positive word written about ABBA until 1990. And then they had this movie coming out in Australia, which I don't remember the name of now, but then Polar and Polygram decided to do this ABBA Gold album, which became number one everywhere. And suddenly everybody came out being ABBA fans forever. So that was kind of a refreshing moment, 1990, which actually helped us quite a lot, because then suddenly everybody talked about ABBA again. And they were four people, we were four people, but two guys wrote the songs. There was one brunette, one blonde. And I was together with Jenny just before the band started, and Jonas was the big brother. So we were family, they were family. So it's a lot of common grounds, and of course, pop from Sweden. So it did help us that everybody, it was quite a boring question though, to have that everywhere in the world, how does it feel to be compared to ABBA? And the answer was always the same. It's very flattering and honored. Yeah.
What did your parents want you to do in your life when you were young?
Well, they put both academics. I'm a little bit now when I have three kids myself. They 18, 16, and 14. Obviously, very much in the age where I should have taken, you know, if I could study or take whatever path. I'm surprised they didn't push me more to be academic, because I think they were very pushed by their parents to actually study and go to, you know, all these high schools and be specialized in different sectors. And maybe because they were so pressured, and that was a different time in the 50s and so forth, they didn't put enough pressure on me. And it was kind of, the 80s was quite wild in Sweden. And I wish they actually did push me more. But on the other hand, I wouldn't start to do music the way I did if they would have pushed me. So I'm not happy they didn't, but I have to rethink this now when I have kids, how much to push and not push, and how to see what are they really interested in. And so it's a fine balance of everything.
I mean, you come from what seems to be a very stable, a very intelligent family. And yet, and I know this is an area you don't really want to talk about, but I want to ask one question only. You had a flirtation with the extreme right in a band called Commit Suicide, and you've denounced extremism since. And you said that was a mistake. I think those both things are true, aren't they? That you've done those.
Yeah.
But it just sort of seems to me, how does, you know, a guy from a very nice, what seems to be, you know, a middle class, intelligent family, mother a psychologist, father a computer programmer, how does a teenager suddenly have a flirtation with the extreme right? How does that come about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And I've been thinking about it a lot myself. And the easy answer is my relationship with my dad has always been a very bad one. Oh, unfortunately, he passed a few months ago. But he was very sick the last 15 years. So we never had the time to really talk through the problems I had with him. So it actually lasted all our lives. I left home when I was 16, and I didn't speak to my parents for many years, and I was lost, and I was looking for a father profile in very dark areas, and I obviously in the end I realized I didn't find it, so I left this shit, but I did ended up in a very bad association with very bad people for a few years when I was a teenager, and that's a big mistake which I'm very sorry I did, and I learned a lot from it, and it made me, I think, stronger when I realized I was so wrong, but I can actually make it wrong right and left it and did something positive about the whole situation instead. But you can see that, and when people are, I think when they are weak and when they are confused, it's easy to catch them up. I mean, right-winged or left-winged or extreme gangs we see today, we have a huge problem with that in Sweden, for example. It's kind of the same thing that you actually end up looking for a family, looking for respect. And it's sad it's happening in such a, I mean, broad part of a lot of different cultures, not only in Sweden, of course. I think it's everywhere in the world where you have this gang problematics. So, I mean, it did definitely help me to have some kind of stability from home, even though I didn't have a relationship with my father, to actually leave my wrongdoings. At the same time, it shouldn't happen in a life that I had, which was as you said, from a middle class, smart people. I had everything really served for me to be good. We lived in a okay area, but I still fucked it up. So, but okay. Thank God I realized that in time, and I could leave it.
Okay, I'll move on from that. Your father taught you computer programming when you were 11, I heard.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that is absolutely insane. I mean, could you really understand it at 11?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, he was that part actually on my dad was very good. So he started to study mathematics with me when I was 4 and 5 already. So I learned the 7 and 8 grade mathematics before I even started school, which was good. At the same time, it was kind of bad because when I came to school, I was very bored because I knew all these things. So, but he was, on that part of it, was very good. So for me, computers were very exciting. So the first program language I learned was BASIC. Then I learned a little more advanced one called Machine Code 83. I haven't really programmed much since then. So I can't really program these days. I don't think they're very relevant in these days either. But it was, I mean, for me, it was very exciting to be able to create something through programming. And that creativity was very helpful when we started to make music as well, to think creative and see what the goals were. And working with computer as the main base in the songwriting.
Were you going out with Jenny when you met Jonas, or did you meet Jonas separately?
I met Jonas on either it was a Kraftwerk or a Depeche Mode concert in the southern Sweden, I think around that in 1983, because he loved synth music as well. So he's 2 years older than me, but we connected very well at that time. And then we kept in contact. And through him, I got to know his sisters eventually, yes. And I was together with Jenny for 2 years.
Now, you formed a band called Tech Noir. Can you tell me about that band and the musical influences which came from both of you?
Yeah, so this was the first experiment for mixing. Jonas were, he loved synth music, but he also loved Italian disco. I wasn't that fond of Italian disco, even though I didn't dislike it either. ABBA was definitely probably the pop phenomena we both liked. But then, I mean, of course, Depeche Mode and Huma Lee and Soft Cell and all these bands, they were really the unifier of our music style. So I brought a little bit the heavier basses, and he brought a little bit more the melodies. And so Technar was the experiment doing kind of a more a house band electro kind of ish style of the music. That later on, when we kind of realized what direction we were going, we renamed the band to Ace of Base. But Ace of Base was actually supposed to be Jonas and I producing other bands as a production team. So we had in our rehearsal studio, there was several different other bands. I mean, there was one reggae band a few studios away, and the walls were so thin that we played very loud music. So they came, they're knocking on the door one day and said, can't we work with you on one song and see if we can, you know, because they heard all these very heavy basses and drums. And so we started to work with them on a couple of songs, and they thought it was great. And we thought, wow, this is cool to experiment with reggae beats in our music. So that's how we actually started to do kind of reggae influence. I wouldn't say that we do reggae, but people always say it's reggae, but it is a backbeat that is kind of reggae stylish, right? But we always saw ourselves as a house band. And when we perform, we always perform the fast 120, 124 BPM songs. But then suddenly people started to like the slower songs, which was not as fun to perform with, especially not at nightclubs. But then, I mean, this just, well, the history is tell them we have Wheel of Fortune and we have all these ones and Happy Nation and the sign. They all
I want to go back a little bit because you're jumping and there's so many things in there that I really want to talk about. How did you finance those early days?
So the great thing with, there's two parts of that. One great thing with Sweden, which actually every songwriter, or the famous one at least, and a lot of the artists as well that came out in the 90s and 2000. It's that the Swedish school system, they allow you to do studio circles and you get funding from that to, for example, renting a rehearsal room. It's not a lot of funding. So it pays for the rehearsal room and music and cables. It doesn't pay for your synthesizers, especially not when you love samplers in the end of the 80s. And technical stuff because we were all very expensive. So Jonas and I decided to look at how can we actually work as efficient as possible so we can build up the studio as fast as possible. So we were looking through all the potential jobs, and the number one job was to be a diver at the oil platforms in Norway. But the problem we realized that it takes like 1 year of education, and we didn't really have the time for that, right? So the second most paid job was to work also with the oil business, but to actually clean the oil containers. That's a very dangerous job, but it was very well paid because it was dangerous. And we got this job, extra job, because two guys before us have jumped into the wrong container without gas mask and they died. So, but Jonas and I, we didn't really think so much. We just thought about the money. But we basically lived in these tanks for every evening, every early morning. And we were always had like oil in the ears and the hair, and we looked like shit. But we got a lot of money, so we can actually go back and buy these very expensive synthesizers. I mean, a sampler, Akai S1000, was €5,000. And that was 1989. So it was a lot of money for us. We had no money, right? Well, our parents didn't have any money either to really spend on crazy synthesizers. So we worked a lot. And then I also started to work extra as a chef on a ferry from Gothenburg to Germany. And that was great because you got a lot of very good salary and it was only very low sea tax on it as well. So we had double work jobs, and then we put everything in the studio. And then we rented out our apartments and we moved in and we lived in this little small studio, which is as big as this little room I'm sitting in now, for basically 4.5 years.
So, well, hang on a minute. This sounds really weird to me. So, you and Jonas lived in a small room for 4.5 years, which was a studio together. I mean, for me,
So Jonas' parents lived 20 minutes walk from the studio. So he kind of lived at home as well. So we used their shower and he kind of lived there. But I lived in the studio permanent, but I didn't have a shower there. So I had to walk back and forth to the house. So yeah, we didn't sleep in the same bed for 4.5 years. That would normally would have killed us each
other. No, I wasn't suggesting that. What I'm thinking of is that the close, you know, it doesn't matter how close you are with someone, really, unless you're in a relationship, but it doesn't matter how close you are with someone when you have that sort of close confines, and even in a relationship, I would think, you have that close confines with some, you're going to have arguments and you're not going to get on. That can't have been, that can't have been easy.
Absolutely, but it was quite hysterical. I mean, we did no drugs, and there was no Red Bulls at that time. We only drank a lot of coffee, and the coffee was so strong you could put the spoon in it. It stood up. I mean, it was really strong coffee, and we worked always 40 plus hours, sometimes even 50 plus hours before we slept. So sometimes you just passed out on the floor. So that's why we lived together, because sometimes somebody slept on his chair. Somebody we slept on the floor because we passed out. Another person continued with the drum loop. That's how we worked for 4.5 years. Was constantly just working and then passing out, basically.
Now, your first gig was without the girls, wasn't it? What was that like? Was it terrible?
Not really. I mean, we really got the girls involved to sing, and so really when we performed the first time. As Ace of Base was 1990 in Gothenburg, and then the girls was with us, But the girls were not so much involved with the songwriting. They were not involved at all in the songwriting on the first album. So they wouldn't rarely in the studio. So they came in to put some vocals. They thought the room smelled very bad when we'd been there for so many hours and days and years. But they came in and came out.
But then it's funny when you think about it. So you must have been looking for voices, okay?
Yeah.
And the voices that you go for are his sisters and your, I don't know if she was your girlfriend at that time, but anyhow, your ex-girlfriend, let's say, and her sister. So in effect, you're not really looking very widely. Did you have a casting? Did you know they had talent, or did you actually test them out in essence?
Well, we obviously knew they were singing because Jonas and the girls been singing all their lives. We didn't really know that they would fit into a band, and that was not the purpose originally either. We needed somebody to put vocals on the songs, and then it was just more practical when we decided that actually we have something now to just send it with their vocals, and it was kind of per se became the band without us really planning who should sing. So we never did a casting, no. And we never thought outside the box. It was very much in the box. and it just happened naturally, I would say, because they were sisters. We knew them well, and they were very close by. I mean, they were only 20 minutes walk from the studio, so they could come in and put some vocals here and there. So it was a very practical choice. It was not very strategic, to say the least.
What did creative expression give you as a human?
I think I my whole personality is very creative, so I can't live a second without trying to be creative or being creative. It's my soul, and it's my hunger, and it's my heart. It's everything I do, even if it's not music or if it's other business. I'm very involved with a lot of different tech companies, but it's always in the creative nerve in it. And I always dream creative wild crazy ideas, and it's just part of my persona to be creative. The day I'm not creative, I think I'm not alive anymore.
I mean, one of the really fascinating things about the band is the long journey to success and the knockdowns on the way. So can you tell me a little bit about when you went out with tracks, what tracks you went out with, and what reaction you got?
Obviously we started to try to get a record company excited about a music in Sweden. It was the most natural thing to do. The problem was we lived in Gothenburg and there was no record companies in Gothenburg. They were all based in Stockholm. And we didn't know anybody in Stockholm. So it was not like we had any contacts or whatever. And we did not really have any money because all the money went into the studio. So we had to hitchhike with the trucks to Stockholm. Sometimes it could take 2 days to get to Stockholm. And this is after we, for a couple of years, have been sending demos with post. And after sending over 100 tapes, different record companies, sometimes twice to the same record company, we got one response once. I think it was EMI. And they basically sent the tape back and asked us to never send another tape. That was the only response we ever got. We tried to call them, nowhere to pick up the phone. But, and then we said, we had to go there and knock on the door. Otherwise, they can't, and they don't listen to the tape. So we started to go to Stockholm and started not really knock on the door. So we had nowhere to sleep. So we slept on benches in parks and things like that. And then every morning we were the first ones at the office. So bam, 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 bam. Have you heard our demo or not? You again, you know, that, yes, yeah, we won't leave until you listen to our demo. So we went through most of the record companies in Sweden. We forced them to listen to the demos. And that was a quite exciting time because nobody really thought, everybody really thought it was crap. And some had the guts to say it, some didn't have the balls to say it. And they felt sorry for us that we did so bad music. Some gave us some directions, what we're supposed to do. We should start with soul music instead or other examples. And then I think after the third or fourth trip to Stockholm, we started to look outside Sweden because we realized nobody in Sweden likes our music. But at the same time, we started to look at Denmark because Denmark had a label called Koma, and they did licensing for KLF, Rosanna, Shaman, a lot of really cool bands out of the UK. And we really loved that kind of that style. So we want to be in contact with Koma. And that was a sub-label of Mega Records, but they were based in Denmark. So we kind of tried to find a way of contact them. It was not very successful. But at the same time, we got a, because I was DJing a little bit, so I got a vinyl from an organization called Swemix, which worked with all the DJs in Sweden. And they send vinyls every month. And then suddenly we had this white vinyl with no marks. Prior to this, just a few weeks before, we went basically through all our collections of vinyls, both Jonas and I, and we have thousands of albums and 12-inch and so forth. And we couldn't find one producer, so because we said, okay, if we have a magic wand, who do we want to work with? For some reason, we didn't even think that Quincy Jones fitted because we did have a Michael Jackson album there too. But we couldn't find somebody who we thought would fit our music, that we knew we were missing something, especially in the beat and so forth. But we didn't really know what. And we listened to all that. Nothing really fit. And then suddenly this white label comes and we play it and we hear this beat and we say, wow, this is what we've been looking for. Who is this? And it took a while for us to realize the band was, there was a singer called Kayo. She didn't write a song, she didn't produce. And who is this producer? And the producer was called Dennis Pop. And so we wanted to meet this guy and it was completely unknown. So we went to Stockholm for a final trip and went to the office. And then René Hedemer was the CEO of Swemix. He was there, but Dennis Pop was in the studio. He said, sorry, he's gonna be busy for 6 months. He's working with this dentist and working with the dentist. I mean, we are from Gothenburg. You have to listen to the demo. And he actually promised, yeah, I'm going to give this demo to Dennis Pop when he's done in the studio. So then we didn't really hear anything from this. Finally, the Danish, we got contact with the Mega Records and they called back. And at that time, it was actually one record company in Sweden who decided maybe these guys have something. But their biggest problem was, in the early 90s, the record stores were, it was, first of all, it was obviously A, B, C, D in order, but it also was, rock, pop, synth, heavy metal, soul, jazz. And this first record company, Telegram, they had no clue how to label us because we did like synth music, pop music, reggae, we did house music, electro, we did so many different styles So he didn't know how to label it and how to market it. So we knew that when we recorded Wheel of Fortune, that he had no clue what to do with us. At the same time, Mega Records calls us from Denmark, who had the label Coma, and said, don't sign anything with anybody. We understand you. We understand all of your songs. And this is Martin Dodd from Mega Records, who later became head of A&R at the Somba. And so he don't sign, and unfortunately, we already signed our several albums and so forth. But we had a discussion with the owner of Telegram and what to do with us, right? And he said, actually, no, I don't. He just came back from London, and Acid were just a big thing, and Sirens. And, well, we're not the Acid band. You don't know. Is it okay if we buy back the tapes? Because we had recorded a video for like $1,000 and the master tapes for like $2,000 for the single. And he said, okay, no problem. And then so Mega Records basically bought us for a little bit less than $2,000, the whole contract. And then we were signed to Mega Records. And then they released the first single and it just went straight up top 10 in Denmark. And then the same in Norway. And it was a big success. And I remember actually MTV, because we had this text TV and they had all the charts from around Europe and also from Israel. And when we saw Wheel of Fortune number 7 on the MTV text TV chart in Denmark, that was actually one of the biggest moments in my life. I still remember it as yesterday when you saw, wow, we are on the chart outside of Sweden. It's fantastic. It was big. So then we had to follow up with the second single. And then we thought, I mean, we have to work with Dennis Pop now, because then we actually heard this Dentist album, and that was Dr. Alban. And this guy really has something. So we called, and then when we called Swimmix, they connected us to Dennis Pop immediately. They said, you know, he's been looking for you guys for 6 months, 9 months. What? So we got hold of Dennis Pop and he said, actually, I got the demo tape when I was in the studio going back and forth from home and recording Dr. Alban, and the tape got stuck in my car. My radio was broken. I couldn't get the tape out. I've been listening on you guys on this demo tape with 8 songs for 9 months now. And I really love your music. So he said, let's get to Stockholm and start working. And 2 months later, we recorded all these songs.
The interview with Ulf will continue in a second, but please subscribe. It helps me, and you'll hear about the newest interviews directly. Now, here is Ulf again, full of surprises.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But DC politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join my Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
I'm going to unpack that a little bit because there's a few things there. First of all, rejection. As a creative person, rejection is very hard. And you really, the way you tell it, I know you've told these stories probably a million times in your career. And I'm not saying they change over time, but they become easier to tell. I've been there, you know, I do that as well. And you've told it in a way that rejection didn't matter. You just got up and moved on and did something. But doesn't rejection hurt? Isn't rejection really hard? You want to achieve something. You wanted to be a successful band, and you're getting knocked down and even told basically, don't ever contact us again.
Yeah, it was like they put up the chainsaw, right? So they completely said we were completely talent and had no talent. It was horrible. I think it comes down a little bit to youth, I think, because when you're young, you're very naive, and some weird self-confidence that I have really hard to. Because I tried to find the formula to get this self-confidence, because if I had that formula, I could maybe teach it to people. But we just had this weird self-confidence that we are good and they are wrong. And it's very hard to say why, because I mean, even Jonah's parents and my parents, they didn't like our music. Jonah's sisters didn't like the music. So it was only Jonas and I who liked the music. But we were so stubborn. We were so stubborn and naive and said, everyone is wrong and we are right. And I don't really have a good answer. Trust me, I've tried to find the formula how we can get so stupidly stubborn. But without that stubbornness, we wouldn't have the band today or then either, right? So I'm very thankful for being so stubborn. But it's just, to answer your question, I don't know.
Yeah, the other thing that you mentioned, yeah. I mean, the mid-80s, 85, Sten Hallström made a statement about remixes and how Sweden could contribute. And this was sort of the basis of where Sweemix came up and where Dennis Pop and, of course, then Telegram being associated with that. You were in Gothenburg, but weren't you aware of this sort of movement that was happening in Stockholm at the time?
We were aware of the things. We had a few DJs in Gothenburg who were in some kind of, you know, they were in championships in Europe and they were winning. So they had knowledge of what's going on around Europe. I don't think we were so much aware of what's going on underground in Stockholm specifically. I think I knew more about Düsseldorf music because of the Klingklang studio, or maybe the London underground music style, you know, then I listened to Sweden. Well, there was a few bands in Stockholm that was great that we followed. Lyssna Stackare, Reaper Band. They were actually all signed to, at that time, a record company called Stranded that was owned by the same owner that had Telegram. So that's, we had some kind of a connection with the kind of synth new wave in Sweden. However, we were looking much more to UK on music influences and a little bit of Germany too, rather than Stockholm. So we didn't know really what was going on, except for these few bands that came out in Swedish from Stockholm.
Now, the other thing is, and this is a little bit of a joke by me, but with Dennis Pop having the CD and it, you know, playing endlessly revolving in his car, you know, I talked to Raz, of Rob and Raz, recently, and he told me exactly the same story about his father and a track that was playing his car. So what is wrong with Swedish cars?
Yeah, this was, I think this was not a Swedish car. I think it was an American car, this one. The stereo was Japanese, for sure. Yes, that's a good question. What's wrong with the cars? Did they get stuck? But I think we both Rob and Raz and Ace of Base can be very happy that some of the stereo system breaks down sometimes.
Well, moving on from that, Dennis Pop, he obviously created, in a sense, then the sound that was Ace of Base. How did that sound diverge from the original demos that you had created with Jonas?
So Dennis Pop's magic fingers was not to add anything. It was actually to erase things, to minimalize things, simplify things. And that was his very unique talent. I mean, Dennis Pop couldn't play any instruments, but he had a very good ear. So basically the first thing he did with all our songs that we worked with him was actually basically to take out 50% of the melodies. Boom, out, gone. And some melodies, for example, some of the melodies that we had in Ola Siobhan's that we had to take out from the track became Happy Nation later on. So it was not like they completely disappeared. Some of the tracks, some of the hook lines, we ended up in songs later on. But he simplified things. And also he was amazing when it came to doing drum beats. And this is also from a technical point of view. We were working with a program called Cubase, and Cubase grooves were not very groovy. It was very stiff, very computerized. He was working with Logic, which they had a little error in the sync clock, so it actually the grooves moved around a little bit. So it was much better and easier to do good grooves with this program. We didn't work at all the same way. We worked very different. So when he obviously completely killed all our drums, everything, and we built it up from scratch. And he just had his magic finger for what actually worked both on radio and in the dance floor. And also another thing that was very helpful was that he played every evening in different nightclubs. So you can take the demo tape, go to the nightclub, test it live, check out what part did work and what didn't work, because you see the audience, how they react, and then go back to the studio afterwards and change these parts and add something and then test it again. So we went back and forth and tested it live, what was working, which was incredible to actually have that tool at hand. And that's really how Dennis Pop created the perfect rhythms and the buildup of songs and so forth that became the famous Swedish sound, Cherion sound.
I mean, the famous Swedish sound, I mean, you were so successful and in the States, which was not usual at that time at all. How did you come to the attention of America?
Well, that's also an interesting story because after conquering, Nordics with Mega Records, and we started to work with Polygram, which is now Universal, in Europe and UK. Of course, UK for us was an enormous market, and we were very flattered that actually it started to play on top 10, and we started to do Top of the Pops and all that stuff. And of course, you know what, MTV, not forget MTV, that without MTV, I'm not sure we would have the success, because MTV just picked up all the shows and started to play it so much. And through MTV, different channels in Europe, and of course also in America. But when it comes to America specifically, Clive Davis, who is probably still today the biggest legend in record industry, had this record company called Arista Record, which our record company, little record company in Denmark, really wanted to work with him. He founded so many different bands over the years. And we were rejected 3 times. By Clive. He didn't like music, he couldn't see the fit in America and so forth. And then the summer 93, he was in Europe, and he was on a boat, and he was in Spain, and then in France, and then in Italy, and everywhere he went, on restaurants, nightclub, radio, bars, they all played Ola Siobhan's, or actually a Happy Nation as well at that time. So he was very surprised to hear that everywhere, how big impact we had in Europe. So when he came back to New York, apparently there's a few DJs who had picked up the songs when they were touring and played in Europe, like in Ibiza and south of France and Greece and so forth, picked up all the songs and they started to play it on radio in America. So we started to kind of bubble on some lists in America, and he was reading about it. And then he made a decision to actually sign us up, but it took a few years for him to say no, say no, say no. And then he just realized, I probably should actually get onto the train. Of course, his version is that he immediately heard that we were a success, but that's not really the full true story. And then of course he did a fantastic job reforming a little bit, because we were kind of surprised working in America. It's very different from Europe, obviously. And fame in America is on a completely different level than you have kind of a little bit, obviously, star, larger than life thing in the UK, but In Sweden, we don't really have that stuff. And I'm very happy that we were from Gothenburg, very simple people. But in America, you become so big when you're famous, right? So they really lift you up in the sky. And if you believe the hype, you're in trouble. I think we were lucky that we kind of had our foot on the ground. But Clive said, I need more singles. Otherwise, I won't release the album. And we had that time already sold 7 million albums and released like 5 singles that were hits. And we said, Clive, we just started to record our second album now. So you better release the first one, otherwise you're going to miss the second one. No. I'm not releasing any albums here and no singles before I have 2 more hits. Wow. And that was a tough discussion with him, trust me. But of course, he was right. So he came to Stock to Gothenburg and he was listening to songs that we were preparing for the second album. And he picked 4 songs and 2 of them is The Sign. And the second album was supposed to be called The Sign. And then it was Don't Turn Around. And they became obviously very big hits in America. And when we got that, he said, now we have the album, now we have the hit, now we go. And then after that, we sold 25 million albums instead. So he was right, even though it didn't make sense at all for us in the beginning. But that was a very healthy, unusual argument that we had.
Success brings many different things. You mentioned fame and you mentioned that Sweden deals with it slightly differently. Fame brings enormous attention. It brings pressures, and if you're in a band, it brings interpersonal pressures in the brand. It brings a lot of money, and that money, although it's, you know, would be wonderful to earn a lot of money, on the other side there's also the pressure of dealing with that money. And also as a band, there was a negative aspect that Ace of Base were, and it's a little bit like ABBA were at the beginning, they weren't treated really seriously as musicians at the beginning. And over time, that seems to have changed. But how did all those pressures sort of affect the relationships within the band?
Yeah, that's a few questions in one question. If I start with the critics of the Swedish, well, of our music, I think the main critics came from Sweden. However, there was probably critics everywhere, of course, but I think in America, we got a very good, had a lot of good press for the music because they thought it was so unique. And I think the American society can actually appreciate when you are unique and so forth. But in Sweden, we had a very similar story to ABBA, that they really killed us in media in Sweden. They said basically the same thing that the record companies have said, that we were the worst thing ever came out. They were ashamed they were Swedish. Somebody described our music that it was like somebody who had thrown rotten spaghetti in the face. Kind of that level of criticism in Sweden. So we basically stopped reading Swedish newspapers because it was nothing good in it at all. I think around the world, it kind of became more of a positive phenomena with the pop and positive energy and message. I think pop music haven't been really on the tracks at the time. And also in the US, there was a lot of hip hop, a lot of soul, but was not that much pop. So we kept, I mean, timing wise for us was perfect music wise. From a creative point of view, we just stopped listening to the negative thing, and we tried to focus on the positive. And then we were so busy as well, because we were basically traveling around the world 24/7, doing interviews in every corner of the planet. Japan one day, and the US the other day, then Brazil, then Germany, then UK, and then back and forth. So we didn't really have time to follow up all the media either. We became a little bit more structured after a while, not just being us four and doing it ourselves. We had obviously the back end of Mega Records, and then of course with Universal and Polygram, and then later on with Arista as well. But of course the other backside of being very successful hit us quite hard with the incident end of 93 with Jenny, where we had a crazy fan that broke in to her apartment, to her house, with a big knife, and she woke up with a fan holding a knife to her throat. It's a crazy German fan woman, but she was big woman, and she basically stabbed through the oak door with a knife, and then she woke up with her sitting on her with a knife on her throat, and luckily Jenny can speak a little bit German, because this girl didn't speak any English. And she said, I need to see your mom. I need to see your mom. And the parents were living upstairs, and the other siblings were not home. They were kind of semi-living with their girlfriend, boyfriends. So she was the only child home. And so the fan brings her with a knife on her throat and drags her up the stairs. And then they wake up the mom, and the mom comes out, and she stabs the mom, and she gets the hand up, she puts the knife through the hand, and then stabs another time, and then the father wakes up, and they could wrestle her down and call the police. But it was a very very traumatic hour of a hostile and violent situation in their home. And this is also a place where she was born, and after having so much success in the world, this is the only safe place you have. And being attacked in your bed, in your home, where you've been basically born in this house, was such a violation of her privacy that was very difficult to handle. And after that moment, our lives went from, wow, it's great to be famous. And it's such a freedom to be famous, because you can get in and anywhere. And, you know, suddenly we had to have enormous security. Really advanced security, bodyguards, a lot of bodyguards, and live in hidden homes and secret addresses, changing names and hotels, and we lived with that security measures for over 10 years, because there was a lot of, and this was a fan who loved us. But I mean, if you look at what happened with John Lennon, it was also a fan, right? And in America, it happens quite a lot. I've noticed the last 20 years, there's actually been a lot of attacks by fans in the US specifically. So it's not like it's unique, unfortunately. It happens all the time, but it's very unique for Sweden. And I think it's quite unique for Europe that this happened, especially at that time. So that changed everything for us.
When were you at the time? Do you remember the moment you heard about it?
Yeah, I was actually, we were supposed to do some recording. So I didn't live in Gothenburg at that time. I lived in Spain or London. I think I lived in London at that time, but I was in Gothenburg. We were supposed to record something. We just came back from Brazil, been touring there. And so I got a phone call in the middle of the night when I heard it. So, and then of course, the first thing that happens when Jenny goes to the police station to take a photo on her with blood on her, pyjamas and the intruder and the knife and all that stuff, and some police guy sold this for, like, you know, 500 euros to the media, and the next day it was world news. I mean, it was front news everywhere. It was not 93, it was 94, because we were big in America at that time. So it was world news everywhere, CNN, BBC, Fox News, you name it, it was everywhere. And that was the last thing we wanted, was actually pictures with Jenny completely in blood in the morning. But that's how media works, right? And also, unfortunately, leaks from police stations as well, everywhere in the world. I was just surprised they did it from Sweden, because here we normally have a little bit more control over these things. But it just changed our lives completely after that day. Yeah, but we decided to continue, which was good. It was very strong of Jenny to be able to handle this, because it was not that we had time to take a 6 month break here. We were in completely middle of a promotion tour, next album, touring, blah, blah, blah. So there was just, show must go on. But she still had, I mean, she's still working on the issue still today, 30 years later, almost.
I mean, I remember reporting on the story on MTV News, mm-hmm. and it being a totally shocking story that I'd never reported on something so shocking before. And clearly that was a moment where it, as you said, it changed the band forever. And in essence, I presume it was, even though the band carried on for a while, it was in essence the beginning of the end for the band. Were you aware immediately that this was it in terms of long term?
No, not at that time, because we were so focused on doing our jobs. And basically, it's a little bit like you are in water up to here to the nose, and you kind of, you don't have the millimeters, you don't have any margins in anything. We were so much into trying to do our best in the, for all the record companies that were dragging us around the world, and also to tour, and also to create new music for the next album and the next album after that. So we kind of didn't see it coming, that this, but it's you're completely right. This is actually the beginning of the end, even though that end lasted for quite some time, but it did change the band a lot, and it did change Malin, especially this specific event, that she, because she was not very happy traveling with us from the beginning. And the more pressure she got and the more pressure the band got, the more distance she wanted to be from the band. But she was kind of the main singer in the band. And also, especially when we hit in America, Clive Davis wanted her to really front the band much more. We knew the problems that she did not want to front the band. We wanted Janet to front much more, but Clive didn't accept that. So he completely recut the videos in America. So we only saw Marlin suddenly. And that was the last thing we wanted to do. So she got even more focus. And then when this accident happened, or this violation happened, of course, this didn't really help Marlin's state of mind either, of being a pop star. And she didn't want to speak about her life, and she didn't like, she's had a lot of integrity. And for her, this was definitely the sign for her to, I don't really like this at all. I want to get out. So, I mean, she wanted to leave the band already end of 93, but we kind of begged her to stay in the band. So I think there's a few reasons why this was the beginning of the end. But we were more focused on the problem with Marlin rather than this specific incident, because it was a lot of incidents with not this dangerous, of course, but more smaller incidents that were was also problematic during the ride.
You mentioned earlier about the influence, or the, you know, that this was a band that brought pop music back to the charts in America at that time. And today, you know, you have people like Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, who cite Ace of Base and your music as being very important to them. How does that make you feel?
Well, incredible proud, of course. It's just, these are amazing, talented stars, artists, songwriters. And I, which I also actually share their music. I love their music. I listen to their music. I'm very flattered to see that they have taken our sound and developed it and made it their own and done something else. This is what we call evolution in music and evolution in culture. So I'm very happy and flattered for it. And of course, our Swedish producers and songwriters like Max Martin, for example, have done an enormous, fantastic job of holding this Swedish pop phenomena alive for so many years. And then he was obviously the protege from Dennis Pop, and now from Max Martin, we have Shellback and all these other guys taking over. So it's kind of a never-ending production of Swedish songwriters and producers coming out still today, which is amazing. I'm very proud of the whole ecosystem that we created here in Sweden, in Stockholm.
Now, I know that Ace of Base went on, and I'm sorry, but I'm going to ignore that part because we're sort of running out of time. And then, you know, you had two other different singers, you had a hiatus, you know, you've had the comebacks and so on and so forth. But you yourself went into tech, didn't you? And you are now an investor in tech. What does that give you that creating music didn't?
Well, I think tech and music for me always have been married, because we worked with tech and computers and of course synthesizers, samplers all our lives. So that's a natural part of tech. And as we discussed earlier, when I was a young kid, a programmer. So I was always excited about the tech tech industry. And in the mid-90s, I started to be involved with a few music tech companies and more as an investor. And then, of course, we had the famous dot-com crash 2000. And then I was a little bit confused. Is this completely a dream that this should work or not? But of course, as we see today, that we were not wrong. We were just too early at that time. But I got involved very early on with tech. I was very excited about it. And I founded a lot of companies, especially within the music tech industry. Amongst those, one company, it's an ed tech company that we work together with Gibson to teach people to learn how to play guitar. But for me, this is another way of getting my creative nerve to work and get my crazy ideas out when I work with these different, especially with app technologies. But I'm laying much more and more into impact investments as well. So we're doing a big project, a few projects in Africa to help entrepreneurs become more, get the tools and the education they need. In South Africa and Kenya and Rwanda and so forth. So that's something it's really close to my heart to take my experience with the music and also with the tech and try to help different societies outside of Europe.
Oh, just one final question. Are you still in contact with Jonas, Jenny and Marlin?
I'm in contact with Jonas. Marlin, I haven't seen I spoke about this with someone a few days ago. I don't even remember when I saw Mona last time, but it probably is soon as 20. I haven't seen it for 18 years at least. Jenny, I meet once in a while in Gothenburg. We go with our kids to the big fun field there called Liseberg. We meet and we do some rides together. We don't really have regular contact. Jonas and I, we do speak on the phone. Normally a few times a year, sometimes more intense when there's something that's going on. Because I do work very actively with the band. We work with a documentary now, and we're doing a lot of syncs with the movies and remixes, and I'm working with a lot of different universities and schools and so forth with the band. So sometimes I need to have Jonas on board on these projects. But he's very, very happy to be in Gothenburg, and Marlon is in Gothenburg, and Jenny is in Gothenburg. So we don't really interact too much, just only when we have to interact. I think we all have different interests. They all like a silent life, and I'm kind of the opposite. I like to travel. I have my adventures around the world, and kind of traveling the same way as I did during the band days.
Sounds fabulous. Well, listen, it's wonderful to talk to you, and I'm really happy that you seem happy and content in your life, and you achieved so much in terms of music, and I'm sure you're going to achieve as much in the tech area. So Ulf Ekberg, thank you, and hope to see you again soon, maybe in a bar in Gothenburg, but you're in Stockholm.
Yeah, hopefully.
That doesn't make sense. I will be going to Stockholm, so I'll see you there.
It's so nice to just hear your voice. It brings back so many good memories. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Steve.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews, and here is where you can connect.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.